Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the offer of amnesty for Edward Snowden made by an NSA official on the CBS program 60 Minutes that has attracted a lot of scorn from many journalists and media critics for its softball handling of the NSA domestic spying issue. A genuine whistleblower who was hounded out of the NSA, William Binney, a 37-year veteran who rose to the rank of the technical director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis Reporting Group at the National Security Agency, joins us. We will discuss the feasibility of the NSA official's offer to Snowden, which was dismissed by his boss, General Alexander, to stop Snowden's leaks, only 1% of which have been made public. Then we will speak with Dr. Guy Martin, a professor of political science at Winston-Salem State University, about the continuing carnage in the Central African Republic. A specialist on Africa who has taught at universities in Botswana, Cameroon, Kenya, and South Africa, he joins us to discuss the military intervention by the French and other African forces that appears to be too little too late in quelling sectarian massacres and counter-massacres in a predominantly Christian country whose Muslim minority government came to power in a recent coup. Then finally, we will look into the murderous intrigue inside the ruling godlike Kim dynasty in North Korea, following the execution of the new young leader's uncle, who was close to the leadership of that failing country's only outside lifeline, China. Sumi Terry, who was the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council, joins us to discuss the possibility that the boy king Kim Jong-un is a modern-day Caligula conducting a reign of terror to consolidate his power, and that this may lead the immature, untested leader to provoke another international incident. And joining us now is William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the technical director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Binney.
Yeah, thank you.
And what was your impression of the 60 Minutes, Sunday 60 Minutes, where they billed it as a great opening for the NSA to get their side of the story over following these leaks by Edward Snowden?
Well, I just thought they were he could have been asked a lot tougher questions, which were not addressed, like what are they doing with all the content they're collecting of U.S. citizens as well as others in the world? You know, that was never asked. And if he said they're not doing it, which I think that's what he said or implied, why he should address a couple issues, like how could the FBI look into all the back email from Generals Petraeus and Generals Allen, and how could Director Mueller of the FBI testify to the Senate Judiciary Committee on the 30th of March of 2011 that he had access to a database that he worked with the Department of Defense to construct, which allowed him to pull out all past emails and all future ones as they came in on a person. Now, with the DOD, the email collection then would be a function of NSA. That's electronic collection. That's NSA's charter. So he's talking about an NSA database. So he's going into an NSA database there. Plus, the focus that he gave was more or less just on NSA analysts' use of the data that they have collected and stored. But no one is really talking about or addressing the FBI or the Drug Enforcement Agency and any law enforcement use of that data also. And they're not addressing that aspect of it.
Well, needless to say, there's been a lot of criticism from journalists and media analysts that basically are slamming CBS for doing a kind of Valentine, and particularly John Miller, the reporter who used to work for the Director of National Intelligence and who is being criticized for these softball questions. So that, needless to say, will go on. You know, 60 Minutes, of course, is reeling from the Lara Logan scandal over the phony Benghazi story. So it looks like they've shot themselves in the other foot with this one, at least from what I'm reading online. But let's go to some of the substance, though, in that CBS 60 Minutes on Sunday, where the Richard Leggett, an NSA official, floated the idea that maybe they should make an offer to, a sort of amnesty offer to Edward Snowden to stop the leaks, and as far as I know, only 1% of the leaks have been made public so far, and they've clearly been damaging to the NSA. So what did you make of Richard Ledgett's offer, which, by the way, the head of the NSA, General Alexander, dismissed?
Yes, I don't. I think he's dreaming to even think of doing that, because that would be basically impossible. I mean, after all, he was actually suggesting that he would have to have assurances that he could get all that material back. Well, that's something that Edward Snowden could never in any way guarantee, because he's distributed around to many different people, and so he'd have to pull it back from all of them. And I'm sure that they're backed up any number of ways, too, so it's basically impossible for him to get that assurance. And so that was basically, I think, a ridiculous thing to even think of.
So what do you know as a former NSA analyst for, you know, total of 37 years, and without getting into classified details, what do you know about what Snowden has in terms of where is this stuff? Is it in a cloud? Is it in the possession of Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras and the Washington Post? Where is this stuff physically, and how secure is it from anybody getting it, from the people that have it now? If you say that Snowden doesn't have it and he's in Russia, and a lot of people, of course, are concerned that there he is in Russia, which is not exactly a friendly country to the United States under the leadership of Putin, a lot of people think that the information is already being compromised. So, well, let's start with that question. Has this information been compromised?
I don't have any information that it has been compromised myself. No, I don't, because it appears to me that, for example, when they stopped David Miranda, Glenn Greenwald's friend, who was visiting Laura Poitras and then coming back to Rio from Berlin, and they stopped him in Heathrow and basically took his electronic equipment and found, I think it was at least 58,000 files there that it applied, that were documents that were applied to GCHQ and NSA. So the data is being held by other people, not Snowden. How much of it they have, I don't know. Some of the estimates I've heard even today is up to 1,700,000 files. And so I don't think they have any idea how much he's really taken. So, but I don't think he's got it. I don't think Snowden has it at all. I think he turned it all over in... It seemed to me from the reporting on what was going on that he turned all that material over to them, and over to Laura and Glenn in Hong Kong.
Again, I'm speaking with William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the National Security Agency. Now, so if that amount of material is out there, what is the justification for taking it all? I mean, the initial reasons given by Snowden in that brief interview that he did for Laura Poitras, he basically said that his focus was to alert the American people to the abuses of its own intelligence services collecting data on American citizens, which the public need to know about. But so much of what's happened since then seems to be unrelated to that, to our domestic concerns about our freedoms. It's more related to what the NSA does abroad, and of course it's creating a lot of problems with allies, etc. So what's go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's not just abroad. I mean, the systems really apply worldwide, including inside the United States. So I it's hard to separate them to the two, you know, from, it's a system of acquisition of information that is, you know, based in the United States, but it spreads all the way around the world. So it's one connected activity.
But in terms of Snowden's focus, or at least his original intent, that seems to have been lost, not the least of which he's stuck in Russia as a guest of a country with a hostile intelligence service. So, you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to get a sense of what the proportionality is here in terms of all of this material. What's the end game? What are we trying to achieve here?
Well, I believe that this is my perspective on it, is that this is, and I think Snowden has the same perspective on it, is that what is going on is not just a a threat to the democracy in the United States, but it's a threat to the democracies around the world. So it's not only our problem; it's a world problem. And this is like what this is fundamentally is what totalitarian states do. That is, gather all the information they can about individual citizens. That's what the Stasi did. That's what the KGB did. You know, and the SS and the Gestapo. They all did that. And it was a way and means of having leverage against the population, controlling the population and all. And that's how totalitarian states operate. So this fundamentally of gathering this kind of information about individual citizens is a totalitarian state process. And what that is they're spreading that around the world. I mean, it's being marketed and being developed here and marketed around the world to all kinds of countries. And Five Eyes are, of course, the ones that are actively doing it now. That's the U.S., Canada, the U.K., New Zealand, and Australia. So, and they're the closest allies in the world, I believe. So, and it's going into other countries like Sweden. We just read some material about Sweden, where they are also getting involved in this and participating in X-Key Score and other kinds of programs that are involving NSA. So, this totalitarian process is being spread around. Instead of being spreading democracy, we're spreading these processes that are anti-democratic.
So from your
I think that's what he thought too.
Right. But from your long experience at the NSA, William Binney, and of course you were a genuine whistleblower, I'm not denigrating Snowden in any way, but let's face it, you never took one piece of classified information out of the NSA, and yet they hounded you and arrested you and held a gun to your head and all of that intimidation. He's taken the crown jewels, it sounds like. I mean, God knows how many files. We don't know. So there's a fundamental difference there. But in terms of what 60 Minutes presented as a kind of Valentine to the NSA to get their side of the story out, what's your sense then of that culture? In other words, you're saying that we are heading down the road towards totalitarianism because of this excessive secrecy and snooping on our own citizens, which is the modus operandi of all totalitarian states. So given that, I guess what it comes down to is we as citizens in this country have to depend upon the kindness of strangers, right? We have to depend upon the idea that General Alexander is a good guy.
Yeah, that's right. It boils down to trust. And what they're finding out over here in my country is that they can't really trust them because they lie to them all the time. They lie to the FISA courts. They lie to the intelligence committees. They lie to Congress. I mean, it's only now with the Snowden material coming out that they're being caught red-handed doing it.
So you don't have the trust. You don't trust them.
You can't trust them.
Right.
I mean, I know these people. They lie all the time. So you just can't trust them. You have to have some way of verifying what they're telling you. Like, for example, let's just say, take the 60 Minutes thing where General Alexander was addressing the question about why couldn't you get the two terrorists who came in from Kuala Lumpur in early 2001 and then made a call back to the Yemen terrorist center that they had back there at that time. And he said, well, we didn't know the calls were coming from California. Well, I mean, you know, they must have disengaged their caller ID. The worldwide public switch telephone network works only if the switches are given the information that tells you where the call is coming from and where it's going to. So if they tell the switches, then NSA gets that data and they know it too. It's just that that's a false statement. I mean, they absolutely knew where it was coming from, but they just didn't pay too much attention to it. That's all. So, you know, that's setting up a false basis for making any judgment by anybody whatsoever. So that's what I mean about you can't trust what they tell you.
Well, now, this was in reference to the two 9/11 hijackers down in San Diego who slipped. The Malaysians had monitored their meetings. The CIA lost them at the airport in Bangkok, and they show up in San Diego. They're actually getting money from the wife of the Saudi ambassador, and the FBI is not told of their existence. And what I find extraordinary is, and this is not exactly to do with the NSA, is that during that period that these 9/11 hijackers were down in San Diego, the CIA officer who knew about them and did not tell the FBI is the same person who was given access to the filmmakers of the movie Zero Dark Thirty about the taking down of bin Laden. It's kind of an irony, don't you think, William Binney, that the filmmakers weren't told that she's the woman that blew it. And obviously that, in terms of making a movie, that would have been some, I think, additional motivation for the character.
Yeah, they could have added to the story, right?
Exactly. Anyway, I digress. Tell me, though, about... See, I don't know Alexandra, and I don't know the culture of the NSA. You do. You spent 37 years there. The fact that General Alexander built the war room as a replica of the bridge of the Starship Enterprise gives me a kind of queasy feeling in my stomach.
Yeah, I think it's more for show than anything else. The substance is not there. I mean, the real point is how do you really produce intelligence from data? And that's not, you don't do it in a chair looking around a room at a bunch of screens. You know, it comes from the fusing of information and the recognition of things that imply intentions and capabilities from potential threats. And that's not done on those screens. It's done by people looking at data and realizing the relationships that are going on.
So are you saying that we're not getting value for money here?
That's right. You're getting a showpiece.
I see.
I mean, how many times have they succeeded in the past few years? Did they catch the Boston bomber? Did they catch the Times Square bomber? Did they catch the underwear bomber? Did they catch the shooter in Fort Hood, you know? I mean, the list is pretty long.
So what's your explanation for why they don't deliver on the billions and billions of taxpayer money that is funneled their way?
Well, I've been saying for quite some time they're taking in too much data, and what it does is it makes them dysfunctional. So they have so much data to look at that they can never get to it, and they can't even begin to assimilate it into a consolidated picture or an understanding of how they could see relationships that are occurring in potential targets that are threatening. So they can't boil it down to the essence of what's important to look at, to make decisions on and inference intentions of and capabilities of potential enemies.
So I've heard the criticism that the NSA's job is to find a needle in a haystack, and since 9/11, all that money and paranoia, all it's done is pile on more hay.
Yes, it's made the haystack orders of magnitude larger, and made it the orders of magnitude harder to find the needle. But it's done a lot. It's done a lot for contractors. It's made a lot of money for the contractors, building storage facilities, managing flow of information, managing storage of information, managing the query process, building software to do the queries, and all of that, and supporting all the infrastructure that was built to maintain all of that for NSA.
So
contractors have won on that.
Well, clearly, and of course, it's worth pointing out to the audience that Edward Snowden worked for a contractor, Booz Hamilton.
Yeah.
They 98% of their money comes from the U.S. taxpayer. And what's happening about holding these people accountable in terms of the catastrophic leaks? At least, you know, according to the NSA official that floated the idea of offering Snowden amnesty to stop the damage, he'd said that these disclosures have been cataclysmic for the NSA.
Well, I don't know what damage they've done. Okay, all they did is expose that they're doing a lot of collection of data, and that means that hasn't changed. They're still doing that, and if people want to communicate to organize a threat attack against one of the Western countries or the United States, they still have to communicate to organize that, so they're still collecting it. So what's the loss? I don't see the loss.
Well, the point I'm making, though, is that is that what has been done, if the intelligence agencies and the NSA in particular, they consider this Snowden leaks disastrous for them. And obviously the White House feels that way, the CIA feels that way, the Director of National Intelligence feels that way. They think that Snowden, his leaks have been catastrophic. Yet, the point I'm making is I don't see anybody being held accountable. After 9/11, the first thing that happened was that George Bush went over to Langley and put his arm around George Tenet. And they're buddy buddies, and obviously there was, Bush did not want Tenet on the outside telling stories about how they screwed up with all the information about 9/11 that was available, which they didn't act on, for which they should be held accountable. They for the reckless endangerment of the United States. So, after Pearl Harbor, they had a whole bunch of admirals and generals got cashiered. I haven't seen anything like that since. As a result of 9/11, and I haven't seen anything like that as a result of the Snowden leaks.
Yeah, that's right. They're not holding anybody accountable. I haven't seen accountability as a process except for whistleblowers,
like yourself. Right.
Yeah, that's right.
That's where they go. That's who they target. Well, look.
That's only to prevent embarrassing things from being exposed to the public too. That was the reason they did that. And that's the reason they're trying to threaten whistleblowers now, to keep everybody quiet from all the unconstitutional and criminal activity they've been doing for a decade.
Well, William Binney, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay. All right. You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right.
And again, I've been speaking with William Binney, who served for 32 years in the National Security Agency and another 4 years in the military component of the NSA for a total of 37 years. He rose to the rank of the Technical Director of the World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and Reporting Group at the NSA. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back getting a report on the tragedy in the Central African Republic.
Beware of pretty faces that you find. A pretty face can hide an evil mind. Be careful what you say, or you'll give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian
man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Guy Martin, who is a professor of political science at Winston-Salem State University, who previously taught at the universities of Botswana, the International Relations Institute of Cameroon, and the Institute of Diplomacy and International Studies in Nairobi, Kenya. Between 1990 and 2004, he taught African politics and international relations at the American University School of International Service, and from 1996 to 1999, Guy Martin was professor and chair of the Public Administration Forum at the University of the Western Cape, Cape Town, South Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Guy Martin.
Thank you.
And what is the latest from the Central African Republic, where there's been horrible massacres and counter-massacres? There's been an intervention of French and African forces. I take it that the latest is from the Muslim military leader who came in a coup. He's now offering peace talks. Is that what you understand?
Yes. In fact, during the past week and I think over 2 days, there was a lot of violence, which led to about 500 people killed. And the French have been trying to stabilize the situation. There are some 1,600 French troops in the country, but a lot of them deployed in the capital, Bangui. And as you mentioned, the President Michel Djoto Diaw took power in the March 2013 coup that overthrew François Bozizé, is now opening or at least trying to extend a hand to the opposition, which is the anti-Balaka, for peace negotiations.
And his offer is to speak with the leaders of the Christian militias, who appear to have sprung up in response to the Muslim militias who slaughtered a lot of people, right? There's been, who started the massacres, in other words?
Well, it's a complex situation that basically goes back to 1990, where the country kind of descended into chaos. But more recently, since the March 2013 coup d'etat, the power has been taken over by the Seleka, which is a predominantly Muslim group, actually originating from Chad and Sudan, and with quite a few mercenaries from those countries. And since they took power, they have been accused of committing a lot of atrocities and human rights abuses. And they have been fighting another group called Anti-Balaka, which is predominantly Christian. So basically, this conflict has kind of descended into a Christian-Muslim conflict where there was none before.
So do you have any idea of what brought about this sectarian violence, short of the coup, which I take it did affect things, since it's a predominantly Christian country that was taken over by a Muslim militia, right? And that it sounds like these Christian self-defense militias have sprung up in response to the attacks by this new government's militias.
Yes, exactly. And the president himself, actually, Michel Djotodia, is a Muslim himself. So there is this aspect. There's another aspect which is not mentioned too frequently, but it has to do with natural resources of the Central African Republic, because it's a fairly wealthy country in terms of notably uranium, gold, oil, and other resources. So while the conflict is going on, those resources are exploited by various groups and factions who benefit from it.
So this is a country with 4.6 million people. 10% have already fled. I don't know what the percentage of people who've been massacred, but as you mentioned earlier, Guy Martin, the French have sent in 1,600 troops, along with the African Union troops there. This is only about 6,000 troops trying to stop these massacres and counter-massacres. Is this a case of too little, too late?
Well, it does look like it. Although, as you said, the French, there is a joint French African Union mission, which is under a UN mandate, actually. And those troops have been positioned in the various strategic areas of the country. But it seems that this should have been done much earlier to stabilize the situation. So it is, in fact, as you said, too little, too late.
But in terms of the natural resources, who's after them? In other words, was there business interests behind this coup that took place, or was this just the ambitions of this president, Michel Djotodia?
Well, it's a conjunction of factors, but certainly Djotodia is interested and has benefited from that, as have other groups also. And the situation is made worse by the fact that the Central African Republic is bordering countries which themselves are rather unstable: the Democratic Republic of Congo to the south and southeast, where conflict is still going on. We have conflict still going on in Darfur, which is bordering Sudan on the northeast. South Sudan itself is just barely stabilizing, and Chad to the northwest is also an unstable country, not to mention the Congo Republic. So I think there is a kind of regional spillover of all these various conflicts into the Central African Republic.
And the only other country you didn't mention there, Dr. Guy-Martin, bordering on the Central African Republic, is to its west, Cameroon.
Mm-hmm.
But Bangui, the capital, is right on the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo, where 7 million people have been killed in the last decade or so.
Yes, that's correct. And mostly in the eastern part of the Congo, north and south Kivu, and in the northeast in the Ituri region.
But at this point, it doesn't look like it's instability from outside that's caused this country to implode into this, well, I don't know whether you could call it a civil war, because it's mostly waged against civilians, you know. Is that the situation, that you have to have a military intervention simply because these militias are preying upon innocent people?
Yes, that's the case. I mean, the Seleka started as a kind of loose alliance of various groups, and doesn't have much unity. Besides, after taking power, it barely controls the capital, Bangui, and surrounding areas, so it doesn't have any control of the whole country. As such, that's why the role of the neighbors, the regional instability, is a factor.
Well, apparently there are also something like 6,000 child soldiers involved. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, these are the figures that I mentioned. It's difficult to get an exact idea of the situation, because those figures are notoriously unreliable, but there are a lot of child soldiers involved, yes.
Well, it's not just, though, that innocent people are being massacred. What seems to be almost incomprehensible is that these militias destroy schools and hospitals, and they loot everything that they can get their hands on and destroy what they don't take.
Yeah, that's the sad part, that they are destroying the whole infrastructure of the country, whatever services are available to people. And as you mentioned, that has created a huge flow of internally displaced persons, some 460,000 in all, actually, including 189,000 in Bangui itself. But not to mention the refugees in neighboring countries. So, yes, the life of the Central African Republic people has been really completely disrupted.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Guy-Martin, who is a professor of political science at Winston-Salem State University, who previously taught at the Universities of Botswana, International Relations Institute of Cameroon, and the Institute of Diplomacy and International Studies in Nairobi, Kenya. Between 1990 and 2004, he taught African politics and international relations at the American University School of International Service. And from 1996 to 1999, Guy-Martin was a professor and chair of the Public Administration Forum at the University of the Western Cape, Cape Town, South Africa. So, Guy, you were just saying, though, how much this country is suffering and how much it's being destroyed from this wanton, you know, completely nihilistic violence. But it was also a pretty impoverished country to begin with before it self-destructed.
Well, yes, I mean, it was not the wealthiest country in the region, but it was at least politically stable, and there was a minimum of services that were functioning, even under Bokassa, much as his rule was disliked, and
mm-hmm.
he was much of a dictator too. But things started to deteriorate really under Francois Bozizé from the 1990s.
But is there any ideology involved in here? When you talk about Muslim versus Christian, is this, you know, the spread of the Wahhabi influence, which obviously has influenced Boko Haram in Nigeria? What's the explanation for the ideological underpinning, or is this just pure nihilistic violence?
I don't think it's ideological. I think it's more pure violence that takes the mantle of religion, which is, of course, a bit dangerous because, after all, Central African Republic is predominantly a Christian country, although there is a strong Muslim majority. But one has to wonder why, in a country that had never known any sectarian or religious violence until now, why is this happening now? I don't think I have an answer to that, but it's a strange occurrence. And who benefits from this? Certainly not the Central African people.
Well, let's end on that note then and figure out who does benefit. Is there any kind of Western mining interests manipulating behind the scenes? You say the country's rich in uranium and gold and oil. Is there any evidence of outside manipulation?
Well, I don't know about manipulation, but certainly outside interests are there. I forgot to mention, well, did I mention the diamonds? And of course the BS is interested in that. There are a number of French mining companies who are also operating in the country, and others. So while the country is going on, they are basically extracting those resources on the cheap, because there is no basically government to pay taxes or to report to.
So it's business as usual for the mining companies, yes. While all around them people are being slaughtered.
Exactly. Which is the same thing that is going on in the Congo, by the way, in Kivu.
Right. Well, that sounds like a subject that you and I should revisit in depth at another time. Would you be available, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Well, any closing thoughts on what can be done? We talked about this military intervention being too little, too late. Can it be beefed up?
Well, it's not in the immediate future. The warring parties, the interventionist stance that France has taken lately, because this is not the only country where they intervene. I'm not saying they're not helping to stabilize a bad situation, but they have intervened in Mali also recently, earlier in Cote d'Ivoire, and not for the good. So we are kind of seeing a situation where African countries, which are kind of falling apart, need to resort to their former French colonial power to assume their defense and security, which is not a good development.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dr. Guy Martin.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Guy Martin, who is a professor of political science at Winston-Salem State University, who previously taught at the Universities of Botswana, the International Relations Institute of Cameroon, and the Institute of Diplomacy and International Studies in Nairobi, Kenya. Between 1990 and 2004, he taught African politics and international relations at the American University School of International Service, and from 1996 to 1999, Guy Martin was professor and chair of the Public Administration Forum at the University of the Western Cape Town, South Africa. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the new young leader in North Korea who just executed his uncle.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sue Mee Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sue Mee Terry.
Thank you.
And what do you make of the execution of Kim Jong-un, the new young Korean leader's uncle, who, of course, is married to his father's sister, and he was something of a mentor from what we understand?
Yes.
It does seem that it has exploded the myth that's kept this dynasty in power and kept the kind of North Korean people in worship and obedience, has been this idea that they are a godlike family dynasty. And now we're learning that there is not harmony, shall we say, within the family.
Yes, it absolutely shatters the facade of regime unity that they were peddling, and it shows that, you know, the elites may not all have truly accepted Kim Jong-un's rule. And this act of executing his uncle, the number two guy, I mean, the guy, you know, of his very mentor, is really unprecedented, even for a country like North Korea. This is the first time in 65-year history of North Korea that a high-level member of the Kim family has been executed. So this also shows me that Kim Jong-un is not, you know, because this tomorrow is the second-year anniversary of Kim Jong-il's death. And I remember when Kim Jong-il first died 2 years ago, many analysts were hoping to see some sort of shift in North Korea's policies, you know, towards greater moderation and change or democracy and so on. Well, these hopes have been dashed. And not only is he, you know, every bit the megalomaniac or absolute dictator that his father and his grandfather were, I actually now think Kim Jong-un is worse. He's even more dangerous and reckless than either his father or grandfather.
So he really could be a kind of impetuous boy almost. You're suggesting that he's more dangerous because he lacks maturity?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he just recently, just a couple of days after executing his uncle, he went back to this extravagant ski resort that he's building. And he just then boasted how everyone in the world is going to marvel at the magnificence of this ski resort that he's building in Pyongyang. And, you know, when people are talking about reforming North Korea, what reform? Everything has been cosmetic and superficial. He built an extravagant ski resort. He built a massive water park, a horse riding club. I mean, if this is not complete immaturity and a sign of, a 30-year-old, you know, boy, inexperienced person, I don't know what could be. This is after he killed his uncle. He went back to the ski resort. So I feel that we're now dealing with, at least Kim Jong-il has had an experience of 20 years of following, you know, being groomed. Kim Jong-un just became this leader, and, you know, it's I'm actually now more concerned about North Korea and the future than I ever was.
So is that to say that Uncle Jang, who was executed, who apparently had close ties with China, which again is hard to believe that since China is the only country that supports North Korea and effectively is their economic and energy lifeline, you would wonder why they would want to hurt that relationship.
Right. I mean, this is why I say he's very impetuous. And I think North Korea's relationship with China is finally in danger now. I can't even begin to imagine what the Chinese would make of this. As you just mentioned, Chang Sung-taek was the face of North Korea. He had a close relationship with China. He was a liaison, go-between North Korea and China. And he was also sort of reform-minded. He was the one who was in favor of Chinese-style economic reforms, and he's been pushing that. Chang Sung-taek is also the one responsible, responsible for the appointment of Park Bong-ju, who is to the post of premier, to spearhead a push to improve economy. So I'm sure this what this execution now both means that Park Bong-ju, who is the premier, and the whole economic opening are both endangered, and Beijing, I'm sure, is very unhappy about this, even though right now they're, you know, they're staying quite mum.
Again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So it would seem to me, again, in terms of this being a self-defeating move, or shooting oneself in the foot here in North Korea, is the fact that all of these phony charges against his uncle, where he was accused of drug use, gambling, and plotting coups, all of which, of course, were broadcast on the only media that the country has. Again, it must, even for the most brainwashed of North Koreans, they must think, something's wrong with the ship of state here. The guy, the number two guy, is plotting to bring down the regime.
No, and I think now what this means is, this Jang's execution may cow the elites at least temporarily for the short term, because their lives are in danger. But I think the long run effect would be very corrosive. The elites now know that this guy is capable of turning on any of them. If you could kill a close relative like Jang Song-taek, then they know they're not safe. No one is safe. So if I were a member of the North Korean elite at the moment, I would be giving a serious thought to either defecting to South Korea or, coming up with some sort of plan to get rid of this guy before he gets rid of me. I mean, wouldn't you think that's a normal thought process as a North Korean elite? No one is safe now. So, right.
So do you think, though, Sumi Terry, that there is a kind of reign of terror going on? The Korean specialist at the University of Chicago, Bruce Cummings, has described Kim Jong-un as a modern Caligula.
Yes, I think absolutely. And particularly, all the Jang Song-taek followers will be gone. In 1950s, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-un's grandfather, did purge many, many people. So I think this is what's going to happen now. Many more elites will be purged, because Jang Song-taek himself had a lot of people who followed him. So anyone with close ties, or even, remotely was close to Jang Song-taek, I'm sure their lives are going to be threatened now.
And those show trials in the 1950s that his grandfather did, obviously they consolidated his power, but did they do any damage?
No, I mean, he consolidated his power, but this is even different, because even Kim Il-sung did not kill his own family member. So, I think it's a very different situation. And you have to remember the fact that Kim Jong-un had no ties of his own. He was not educated in North Korea. He did not have his own network of people. He's only 30 years old in a society, in a very Confucian-like society where age matters, experience matters. He's inexperienced, he's young, he's untested. And now we know not all the elites were behind this guy. So I think this is just a bad sign going forward. I don't think any elites could trust him, not with coming up with the right policies. Not only that, but I think now everyone will be overly scared. I know that's what Kim Jong-un wanted, is to scare the living crap out of the elites. But I think this will have a long-term negative effect for Kim Jong-un.
Well, we know that this regime is capable of creating outside tensions in order to foster internal cohesion. They do that regularly. They sink warships on the South Korean side. They send over agents to do assassinations. They threaten war. They closed down the enterprise zone recently. I mean,
yes.
There's been a series of these actions. So does that mean that we should expect another threat on that Korean peninsula?
Absolutely. I can bet everything. If I'm a gambling person, I'll bet everything I have on that. Already, this whole provoke and get paid cycle, we were on the peace offensive cycle. Remember earlier this year with the third nuclear test and so on, there was a whole provoke cycle, and we were on the peace offensive cycle, and there was already, we're reaching the end of that cycle. So now, with this kind of instability, increased instability at the top of the North Korean government, they have every reason to go off with another round of provocations to consolidate control and to tell this is, it's coming. I would say a matter of maybe months. So early next year, I expect another missile test or nuclear test or another limited attack against South Korea, such as the Chonan Sikking, before long.
So, Sumi Terry, I recall, I think it was after the last series of threats, that North Korean state media showed Kim visiting various military outposts, and he came ashore in a little boat like George Washington, and then I recall seeing these, elderly generals and colonels or whatever in the North Korean army literally weeping with adoration as though, the Messiah had returned. and so this is what scares me. And, you've obviously studied the country for a long time and worked on the National Security Council, advising presidents and national security advisors about what to do. If you have a combination of an immature young guy who's drunk with power and perhaps is somewhat delusional, and then you've got these sycophantic generals who are trying to not only prove themselves, but they're afraid that they're going to be executed too, aren't they going to come to him with all kinds of crackpot schemes?
Very much that's a possibility. So not only should we be afraid of the traditional form of provocation like a missile test or nuclear test, but they could come up with something even more creative and more dangerous. That's what I meant by Kim Jong-un now looking like he's even more dangerous than his father. And I never thought I would say that. I actually miss Kim Jong-il than dealing with this guy. Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct in thinking that.
So what do you hear from South Korea then?
I think they're bracing for a potential provocation to come. It'll be interesting to see what President Park does under this whole new trust politic policy. Part of that is to not cower to the North Koreans. And if North Koreans act out, the South Koreans will now respond in kind. So we will see what President Park does. So we're entering a dangerous period in the next coming months in the new year. I know North Koreans will act out, and South Koreans promised this time that they will return fire. So, we're entering a period of some sort of dangerous period.
So, but what about the broader geopolitics in that area? We've already had a lot of tensions over China's claims over islands, which they tried to claim the airspace. It led to the U.S. flying B-52s over these islands that both Japan and China claim. There's also a territorial claim between South Korea and China over some submerged rocks, which have created also some tensions. So I'm trying to figure out this triangulation here between the North and South Korea and China, where you have a paradox that where South Korean movies and television are popular in China, as are South Korean goods, tremendous trade between the two. On the other hand, China basically, gives an economic lifeline to this failed state next door to them, and there are a lot of exiled North Koreans in China who apparently have all been recalled by Kim Jong-un, and that's got to be scary as hell when you get recalled by a guy who's just executed his uncle. So I'm trying to understand here what will happen to that, what's going on between China and South Korea on the one hand, and the fact that the Chinese must be upset that the
there's another wrinkle geopolitically in the region. There's also South Korea and Japan. Their relationship has not been that great recently. But listen, I do think that this Zhang's execution presents an unprecedented opportunity here to work with the Chinese. China has been this year increasingly showing concerns about the direction that Kim Jong-un has been taking. More so this year than the past, let's put it that way. In late September, China issued this whole big, long list, 236-page list of dual use and other materials with potential military applications that it was banning from exports to Pyongyang. And they've been doing this kind of things increasingly more so. So I think Zhang's execution is likely to further strain relationship between Beijing and Pyongyang. Because as we talked about, Zhang was the chief envoy between the two states. So I think this could potentially make Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, more receptive to further curbs on, cracking down on the North Koreans and particularly their nuclear and ballistic missile program. So I do think this actually presents an opportunity for Madam Park, President Park, and President Obama to try to really engage the Chinese. And until now, it has been very, very difficult to do that, as you know. But I do think this time there is an opportunity. I mean, Beijing cannot be happy with this. They must be quite nervous about what is going on in North Korea. So, and I know that, and you know that Beijing has been historically unwilling to apply too much pressure to North Korea for fear of precipitating a regime collapse. But I think Kim Jong-un's erratic behavior may be, somewhat changing the calculus in Beijing. So this is still an opportunity to talk to China.
So I've followed the Chinese media, and apparently they've, since Kim Jong-un came in, there have been some reports in the Chinese media that have been very critical of him, and there have even been some references to the fat boy, the spoiled kid. Those kind of references, which I find pretty surprising coming from China, they're not totally official, but at least they're in the media, and anything that gets out in the media in China is, by definition, official.
Right. No, absolutely, and this is what I mean. So this year, we've seen much more of that in academic journals, more Chinese, at least in track two, a lot of Chinese scholars, academics have been saying that, and Xi Jinping himself criticized Kim Jong-un by name earlier. So I do think there is definitely an opportunity for South Korea and Washington to talk to the Chinese, as I said.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.